This is Robert Dillon, the host of the Help Me Understand podcast. Thanks for taking some time to be a part of this project. Listening for ideas and inspiration in a world that continues to be filled with noise is at the heart of this podcast. I'm excited to share my journey to understand in deeper ways by listening to the passionate ideas of educators, thinkers, and entrepreneurs. Help Me Understand is a small opportunity to be hopeful and experience the best parts of humanity.
Good day, and welcome back to the Help Me Understand podcast. I'm excited to have a number of new episodes coming out over the next few weeks. I've been busy working with schools and districts around the country, but I've been sneaking in a few moments to do some podcasting. So today's guest is Christina Ishmael, and we are talking about going back to school in this COVID pandemic. We talk about life and school and all of the things that are changing, and really the things that we are hopeful will continue to change as we leap forward. I hope that each of you enjoys the podcast, and I will be back to wrap things up at the end. Christina, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, so it's been a while since many people have connected the dots that you have moved across the country. So where are we finding you today?
You can't typically say this sentence, but from sunny Portland, Oregon.
What? It's sunny.
It is sunny outside. I know, it's shocking. I moved in mid-June from DC. So, you know, cross country in a pandemic was very smart on my end.
Yeah, it does add some complexity to things. But you are now a proud car owner again, yes?
I am. I'm very excited about that. After living in DC for 4 years without one, I decided to, you know, fulfill my Pacific Northwest dreams and become a Subaru owner. So, and of course, I couldn't just buy a regular, like, gray, white, normal color. I went for the tangerine Crosstrek that seems to be pretty loud and obvious, you know, just how kind of live life.
Right. And what doesn't come through from the podcast is this is the person with her hair talking about her own car. There's never a bad time in life to be colorful.
It's true. So true.
And then another move is coming. You wanted to click off another state that you've lived in. Nebraska, now DC, Arizona, Oregon.
Right.
The state of Washington is now receiving you with open arms.
The state of Washington will soon be my new home, starting this weekend, actually. I'm moving to Tacoma. The South Sound. I'm learning all of the lingo and the language to be able to use. And I'm very excited about my new apartment. It has a view of the Sound, so I will have a water view, as well as the one thing that makes me very, very happy as a 90s teenager, Tacoma High School, where 10 Things I Hate About You was filmed.
Yes. Walkable or like?
Oh yeah, also you can see it from my apartment.
Fantastic.
So I've had a couple of friends that know how much I love that movie. They're like, you're going to go recreate that scene on the stairs, right? And I said, well, it's not being used right now for school. So what's stopping me?
Yeah. So lots going on. But like, I think one of the questions I love to just start with is this idea about hope. So a lot of reasons not to be hopeful, but what finds you hopeful this week? What are you hopeful about?
I think, I actually like started out on this whole adventure across the country because I was supposed to be moving abroad for a year. While my plans were certainly canceled due to COVID and all of that, I'm actually hopeful in the sense that I'm replanning and doing some different things that I had not anticipated doing. And that includes obviously experiencing Portland for a few months and now headed to Tacoma, and who knows where I'll go after that. But a lot of time to kind of sit and reflect and be more, you know, internally focused during this whole thing. I do live by myself, and so there's a lot of that time available. And I think it can certainly get lonely at times, but it also can be really good and hopeful in that time to be able to think and kind of plan Manush Zamarodi calls it autobiographical planning. And really thinking about like what you want your next steps to be. And I think that's both personally and professionally. And so I would say kind of all of those things. Also just kind of the reckoning of where we are as a country right now and thinking about, you know, Portland has experienced some pretty serious things this summer. And while I am not downtown where it is happening within kind of a, you know, a few block radius, I do live right across the river and I can hear everything because it kind of echoes and bounces off the river. And so I've heard the flashbangs. I hear the choppers on a nightly basis and it's really real, but also coming from DC where it was also really real. And so I'm hopeful in this moment that we can make changes.
Yeah, and I actually think the only thing we can guarantee over the next 12 to 18 months is change. That in itself is kind of unsettling and can be hard, or it can be embraced. It can be both.
Yeah.
It can be hourly, right? I think we all are kind of in a living hour to hour. If we get too far in front of our feet right now, I think we'll just stumble over life.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
although I still want to think about being able to travel again.
Yeah, I absolutely. I think that there's something about experiencing a new place and traveling and the people and the food and the music that is intoxicating, whether that's domestically or internationally. And so that is definitely missed in my space as well. It's a start of school for lots of folks.
It is.
As we record this, I've known some schools that have been in 2 weeks, 1 week.
Yep.
My daughter started today. I've been observing school from the basement. We've got to spread out on the Wi-Fi, right? So,
don't want to overburden it too much. Yeah.
Yeah, it's rare to be an educator, and whether you're educating adults or children, and not partake in the rush of school. So how is that impacting you? Yeah.
This August is the first August that has felt so different. And I know that we're now officially into September, but August was always, you know, when I was teaching, it was back to school. It was time to think about new faces and new names and new stories, whether it was my kindergartners or later on when I was an EL teacher and getting to meet new students from all around the world. To when I moved to the state level, August was, you know, crazy as far as all of the professional development that was happening. I was traveling across the entire state of Nebraska, you know, meeting at different conferences and different trainings and back to school professional development. And then of course at the federal and even at most recently a nonprofit level, still being a part of a lot of those same professional development opportunities. And so it's just felt very different, like everything else this year. And while I've been able to connect with a lot of folks through Zoom and through other kind of video conferencing tools, there's just a different feel about this year. And I think a lot of it is uncertainty and kind of a lack of hope, I would say, some for some folks. There are just so many unknowns at this moment. And it's hard to be really positive because I'm such a like positive person and I want to bring that to folks, but it's also like facing the realities. But Julie Young, who is the director of ASU Prep Digital out of Arizona State, we were on a panel earlier in August and she said, we cannot waste this crisis. And I thought like that has just really stuck with me this whole time. In thinking about what that looks like, not only for schools, but for our adult learners and what the system of school can potentially look like too.
Yeah, this idea that no matter where we are now, we can't reach back for safety, but we have to reach forward with what's possible has really resonated. And I'm seeing a tech confidence, a use of technology in the classroom confidence that I've never seen before in the United States.
Yay!
Great. Whether people wanted to be confident or not.
I know.
But I'm also seeing a realization around this idea that in this crisis, we are going to be able to teach kids how to learn online.
Yeah.
And that isn't going to go away. So whether you're doing training in the military or you're a carpenter or in college, you're going to do online learning. And so in the past, one kid at a high school took one class. Now we're talking about third graders through 12th graders being able to really build these skills. Yeah. And that might be a really positive thing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I keep referring to the field of distance education as a whole whenever we're talking about all of this right now, because it has a history with correspondence courses that started well over 100 years ago. And, you know, like here in Oregon, we talked about different ways to engage families, both online and offline, because we have a lot of really rural areas that just have no connectivity. And so what are some of the ways that we can do that? So we can work towards this online, you know, teaching environment or this online learning environment, but we also have opportunities to really kind of learn from, you know, shortwave radio or public broadcasts or like correspondence courses for that matter. Come pick up the packets of things and like let's engage through regular text messages or whatever that may look like. And so I think there are ways that we can kind of scaffold it so that we can get kids to a place, hopefully with some work with the FCC and the federal government, so that we can increase overall connectivity at home. But it is an opportunity for us right now.
Yeah, and I do think that some of the exposure to systems, not people, but systems, mm-hmm. have really left us in a place where we don't have a choice but to come up with some solutions. And part of that's about connectivity, part of that's about supply chain, part of that's about communication and how hard it is these days to communicate with our parents, who are more diverse than ever, busier than ever, in the workforce in different ways. And so I think that all of those systems have to really kind of be rebuilt. I don't think we can just adjust some of these systems.
Right.
I think we do have to
rebuild. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then what role does the school play as far as, you know, being kind of that community center? And, you know, we've been forcing all of these different roles among teachers and even school leaders. What does that look like if we were to change it so that we were really involving the community? How can parents be part of that? We need bilingual liaisons. We need those wraparound services where, you know, my first school in Omaha Public Schools added a community health center. And so when my students got sick, instead of sending them to the nurse, they went straight to the doctor. And so how can we do more things like that? And what role does the community play in this?
Yeah, and we're innovating in telehealth ways, and we're doing things. I spoke to somebody that we both know that's now working for a company that's doing telehealth for schools. And, you know, I think there's a huge market there, not only a need and a social need, but like there will be a larger market. You know, the other day we're hearing about the huge number of schools that really don't have daily service from a nurse. And I think that, you know, as large companies say, we need to have a doctor as a part of our cabinet. Schools have to have nurses that are central to the conversations. And that hasn't always been the case.
So does that, is that just exclusive to nurses, or does that also include any sort of mental health services or counselors, psychologists, anything like that too?
Yeah. Yes. And right. I mean, all of the wraparound services that we're needing. And there are some models I know here in the St. Louis area where a number of districts are really thinking about how to not only ask their service providers to provide services, but to provide impact.
Yeah.
And that's a really different mindset. Like you can say we have 35 service providers.
Right.
And you can say they've met with this many kids, but if they haven't made change, they're providing service in the forest and where there are no trees. So like, right.
Yeah.
So, I think that'll be an interesting thing to look at as well as we kind of extend out of this.
And is that all student focused or is that also teacher and staff focused? Cause that's something else that I don't think we're necessarily talking about very much. And I would love to have more of those conversations around mental health for teachers right now.
Yeah, a number of years ago, our friend Jenna Shaw was working in Baltimore around that, and it was kind of a fledgling idea maybe before its time. But absolutely. I mean, I've watched now a couple of school districts here in this area start to say, well, we were going to ask teachers to do their virtual teaching from their physical classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And some people need that space. That's totally cool.
Sure.
Doesn't work, or they need quiet or whatever. But to give people that flexibility and that trust is a huge olive branch to mental health, I think, to be able to even say like, you know what, there might be days where you don't have to take a day off. You've planned this. You've set up a totally asynchronous day.
You're good.
That's another bridge I'm not sure that people have started to think about. Like, could a teacher say, hey, I'm not doing a synchronous day. I'm just going to do asynchronous because I need to take some time for myself.
Yeah.
And everyone be okay with that.
That's a really interesting idea, because I think about that from the nonprofit that I left in June. where once we went into quarantine in March, you know, we shut down the offices in DC, and within the first couple of weeks, we had leadership checking in with us often. And I knew that I was leaving at that time, and I watched it kind of all unfold and seeing how like leadership just stepped up in that moment. And they're like, okay, from now on Fridays, we're having Wellness Fridays. Please do not schedule any meetings. You get to use that however you see fit. If you want to read books, read books. If you want to binge watch a series on Netflix, do it. Like, so they gave us permission to do that without having to take any sort of time off or, you know, sick leave or anything like that. And it made such a difference. And then we also did these informal community check-ins every Thursday, just for 30 to 45 minutes, where it started with some deep breathing and like chair yoga, which I'm always a fan of. And you see like your colleagues on Zoom, you know, doing all of the things with you. And that mattered so much to me in that moment. And I just don't see that necessarily happening in schools right now, which is deeply concerning because we know the pressure that they're facing. We also know, like you mentioned, the communication with families and communities. So like if a teacher were to do this whole asynchronous day, how do we then communicate that that is still working? You know what I mean? Like there's not that face of, well, they're just kind of slacking off right now. And you're like, no. There's been a lot of prep that's gone into this. And they're still doing they're still engaging with kids and kids are still learning. So I don't know.
Yeah. I think one of the things I've been asking teachers to continue to think about is how do you let families and the community under the hood of online learning, right? Like when lots and lots of folks do not have a mental model of what this is or should be.
Right.
And
right.
So when it varies from what they're used to in physical
face-to-face environment, yeah.
That we have to start to say, like, here's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Here's why this makes sense based on the learning science, or here's how I'm new.
Yeah.
And kind of unpacking online learning.
I like that.
For families, because then some of these things like asynchronous time and stepping away and all of these things make sense. They don't make sense when you grab old mental model, lay it over this, and then try to have that conversation.
Yes. And I think that was one of the things that I really kind of leaned on my two co-authors for our distance learning report. Jenny Payne works in a blended school within a traditional public school system, you know, in a suburb of Denver. And she was like, you know, this was our model. We had kids 2 days a week in person. The rest of the time was done asynchronously. Participation was how we did attendance. And so like that was an actual model that we could take and learn from, as well as my other co-author, Rebecca Heiser, who's an instructional designer for Penn State World Campus, who's been helping faculty make that transition. And we have a lot to learn from higher ed when it comes to all of this as well, just how they've been doing this for so long. I remember taking a hybrid course during undergrad at Arizona State. So in 2001, my like initial English composition course was 2 days in person and the rest of it was online. And so they have more history than we necessarily do in the K-12 space, and we have a lot to learn from them.
Yeah, I've been pointing teachers to kind of what we learned about MOOCs, right? Like, so when that happened, that's not the only model, but one of the things we learned was great content and great instructors do not make up for community and conversation. And so if we can get more community and more conversation into these online spaces, you're going to raise engagement and interest and people's stick-to-itiveness to the work. And as in the MOOCs, 50, 60, 70, 80% of people dropped out. Content great, instructor great, but didn't feel any left sense of connection to the work.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's another great example to think about too.
As we kind of think about some of these other things that are kind of floating around, we were talking about being outside and outdoor learning. I just wonder what state people are standing in when they're like, we should just do outdoor learning all year long.
I'm going to say it's not the Pacific Northwest.
Right. Like, is it somewhere
not the in desert.
Like, Orange County in California or something?
Right? I know.
Yeah, I mean, yes.
San Diego.
We always prioritize air, right? We should always get kids natural light. But have they been to Burlington, Vermont?
Exactly.
There is an Upper Peninsula of Michigan, right? Like.
Right, right. Or when I was my last actual like official travel for work was in Cleveland in February. And then I got snowed in at the airport for 5 hours. Like, yep, Yep, yeah, that is a thing. I can't imagine outdoor learning happening there.
Yeah. And so I'm always cautioning people, like, the thing that pops up, that is a really cool thing in that space, in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
But big education solutions have to scale.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff that we're doing right now that's cute and neat doesn't scale. Doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it locally, but it
sure
isn't systemic solution making.
Right.
And
right.
So I do worry about when the next shiny thing always gets
I will say that I had to actually go do some research on resources for outdoor learning and kind of outdoor classrooms recently. One of our global members of OpenNet Global, where I am now, from Uganda, reached out and said, you know, like, we really want to move to more open educational resources instead of kind of these traditional materials we've been using. They were able, once they went into quarantine and kind of lockdown, they sent home a bunch of packets because they realized that no kids were going to have connectivity at home. They were able to think about kind of basic smartphone usage and how they could repurpose pre-existing tools in order to meet with kids still. And so they were actually using WhatsApp in small groups with the teacher and students to continue the teaching and learning, which I think is just such a cool story. Like, yes, I can't imagine that happening. Yeah.
Teachers are solution makers. We will find a way.
They are. But then they're thinking about going back, and they start in a couple of weeks now. They can have small groups similar to a lot of kind of guidance here in the States, of 10, maybe 12 to 15. And so they were wondering, they have outdoor space at their school, could they do that? And so I sent a bunch of resources their way and also introduced them to project-based learning and inquiry-based learning to kind of tap into that natural curiosity of kids and let them do some learning on their own.
Yeah, and you know, there's a deep bench around kids learning outside, you know, whether it's expeditionary learning, whether it's place-based learning.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of stuff. The Teton Science School is always the place where I need to visit next.
I don't know this.
But like, everything about the place-based learning environment is really there. So yes, no, they're not outside every day, right? Like, no, they're not playing in the snow. But the cool part, and I think a great segue here, is that place-based learning is a acknowledgement of your surroundings. Right? And I think that some of our kids are very knowledgeable and very aware of what's happening around justice in so many. And I think place-based learning asks students to step into their sense of place in the community and their sense of place in the world. And so I think there's a deep piece around the difference between go outside and really be a contributor to the place where you live. So that can go pick up trash, but it can also be to advocate for change.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm also like, I just think about the early childhood and kind of elementary background in where kids are very egocentric through the age of 8, and like, developmentally that's appropriate. And so to get them, you know, when they think about themselves as well as their families and communities, then they start to expand that sphere of knowledge as well as the influence, and then think of the larger community. But we've got pre-K as well as kindergartners that can do that kind of work. And so they do understand our communities, or it's an opportunity for them to learn more about their communities. So I think in all of these conversations around online learning and distance learning in general, I've been most worried about our youngest learners, because again, those are the grades that I taught, and knowing that the foundational skills really come at those really critical years, but also recognizing that kids can do this kind of work and contribute to the community is critical. And we're not necessarily recognizing that. So that is something that can certainly happen.
Yeah. I think when we peel all this away and kind of do the postmortem on all this, we're going to see that the pre-K, K-1-2, is going to be a place where we've really struggled to do online well for a number of reasons, and it's not teachers or their interest in doing it that way. It's a really hard thing to do in that space, and so we're going to see that if we go back into a space, or when we go back into a space like South Korea has, that's going to be a focus of us trying to figure out how to do that piece in a better way.
I actually have a friend and a former colleague from the Department of Ed whose husband is stationed in South Korea. And so she sent her kids back to pre-K and kindergarten, and they max out at 10 kids per classroom. The distancing is much more possible because of that. When I look at, you know, our school class sizes here, it's very different. And so now her kids are used to wearing masks all day. They can't high five their friends. Like, they can't participate in centers or do a dramatic play. And like some of those, again, foundational skills. And so, yes, I think you're right. As far as the reflection, when it comes time to really think about this, engaging our youngest learners is going to be probably an area that we can always improve upon. But what does that actually look like now, you know, in more longitudinal kind of surveys and assessments of what this, what took place?
Yeah. Over the next few weeks, probably 3 weeks away, I'm going to really start nudging a number of school districts to start thinking about 21, 22. I know that sounds,
But
if we don't get out of the urgent, we'll never talk about the significant.
Yes.
If you were speaking to them, a part of that planning, what couple of things would you hope that people had on their longer horizon around doing learning better?
Ooh, that's a really good question.
Right, like we've been so pandemic focused, right? Like,
I know, so, everything has been very reactive and crisis, and figure this out.
Yeah, really trying to get people to start to say, okay, if, you know, this year isn't a wash, we'll be okay, we're gonna take care of kids, and we're gonna make the best of it, but what's that next phase look like?
Yeah, so I'm curious, once schools get to a place where they can come back face-to-face, if they would consider more of a hybrid model, because I really do think there's value in it, where you have certain kids that are in, you know, traditional classrooms in a face-to-face environment for a couple of days a week, and then everything else is done online, just because that is kind of the, you know, the environment that they would be facing as adults, as citizens, really. And so could we set them up for success? You know, we think about college, career, and citizen ready, like, is that a way for us to really look at this? And really giving that learner agency and all of that so that kids could also choose which days they came back. But then, you know, even thinking about the instructional materials that are involved with what that, you know, would entail as far as, okay, a student picks this, if they are doing some inquiry or doing a specific project, great. What are the resources that we're going to use to support that learning? And I'm hearing more and more conversations around materials right now, which of course is kind of, you know, my field and what I specifically focus on. But it has been interesting, given the unrest in the US right now. People are asking questions now. I'm having a conversation with a major league soccer player right now who is really interested in teaching social justice. And he's like, how do we get this in the curriculum that K-12 students know about this? And so it's not just educators that are going to have to think about this or the leaders that are making the decisions. Again, it goes back to that community idea where we've got community members that will now want to be a part of this. And I think we've got a chance to really shoot for something different.
Yeah, and my hope is I would love to walk through a process where we said, okay, we know there's more stuff that's important. I just finished reading The Permission to Feel out of the Yale Child Center and talking about emotional regulation. So we know there's other things that matter, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, as we figure out how to have difficult conversations in the classroom, very important. But we have to get rid of stuff. And so I wish we could spend 4 months saying, like, this is the stuff we're taking out. Right. And especially at a time and place where we know we've had to compact curriculum in this online space, we might be primed to be like, cool, like we identified these things. That's what we're moving forward with. The rest of the stuff's in the trash bin forever, as opposed to we're bringing it back next year. And then we could layer on some things. So I just think that even that type of process could be a really healthy one for some schools.
Sure. And, you know, like that is the question that has come up often is, are states doing that right now with standards? Are they identifying kind of those power standards, whatever you want to call them, but the standards that we know are really, really critical, like 10 of them instead of the full list of all of them? And as far as I know, no, sadly, because I think
districts are
helpful.
Some districts are.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think We have a lot to learn from the districts that are doing that. And then of course, sharing that as well. So like a Liberty Public Schools in Missouri has done that with their OER work. And now they're looking at it from where we are now. You know, they're really making sure that they focus on those power standards for this school year, and others that are doing that too, to find the materials again that will help kind of lend themselves to those standards as well.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting. If you had to say a year from now, school starting, what do you hope to see a year from now when school starts for 21-22? Maybe in our schools and in our communities and around the country, what are you hoping to see?
Yeah. Hopefully more proactive approaches rather than reactive. I would love to see teacher leaders lifted up in the work that they've been able to do, and that they can show and share that with others so that that could potentially be replicated in other places. And I was talking to Joseph South from ISTE about this last week, where it was like, we want to prepare students for college and career, but really what we are trying to prepare them for is life. And so are we in our current system right now, are we actually doing that? Or are we just saying that we're doing that? And so how could we really walk the walk, really? So that's gonna require some changes, obviously at the policy level, you know, whether that's from the federal level, state, or even just the local level. I just hope it looks different. I hope it looks different.
Yeah, so I know we were talking about the podcast Nice White Parents, and I'm not gonna go way deep in that, but like one of the things I was thinking about on my run this morning was I listened to the final episode, and it was a good wrap.
Okay.
Good podcast.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
But I'm wondering right now, in the past, Nice White Parents have impacted schools.
Yeah.
Now Nice White Parents are impacting the learning at home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what both the positive and negative effects of that group of parents are, since they're not impacting the school. What are they doing positively and negatively? So it might go to kind of tiger mom and helicopter parent, maybe all of that pushed in the same
bucket
there.
Yeah.
But like, how much, you know, are kids positively allowed to fail in the classroom where that's totally pulled away in this school year? Or students get to dictate where they learn or what their schedule is at school at some level in best class.
Sure, sure.
How much of that's getting torn away? So we're actually creating homes with very, very supportive parents, right? That are actually taking our kids down the wrong road, not by intention, but by just lack of knowledge. And so at that point in time, we're not preparing them for what's ahead.
Absolutely. So,
just, you know, random running thoughts, you know.
You have good random running thoughts.
Yeah, not surprising. So, yeah. So,
well, and what, then does that cause further issues then where, like, potentially Nice White Parents then say, we're completely opting our kids out of these traditional systems?
Yep.
And does that cause more issues further down the road? I don't know.
Yeah, there's definitely a death spiral that comes from that, right? Like, if so many people leave the system, it leaves it financially strained, and then you have to pull away somebody, then you have larger class sizes. It's that whole death spiral that happens. So,
of course.
Yeah. So moving this weekend, what do you said what you're excited about your place. I don't know that part of Washington. If someone were to come there, what else would they be excited about?
It's the best of all of the worlds where you get ocean, and you get the green of the Pacific Northwest. So I think when I pulled up my All Trails app, there's over 500 trails nearby within like 20 to 30 minutes, which is fantastic. I'm looking forward to that. So Tacoma, if you're not familiar with it, it is on the south part of the Puget Sound, Seattle being further north, the airport, SeaTac being right in the middle, which is great. But Tacoma has traditionally been the blue collar city. And because Seattle has been so gentrified and in all areas, it continues to increase in prices so that it's, you know, one of the top five places, top five most expensive places to live in the country, it's pushed a lot of people out. And so they're coming further down the Sound to some of the little kind of suburb areas or the bedroom communities. And Tacoma is technically considered part of that. which is really interesting. And so the first couple of times I visited this summer, there's just a different feel, like a different vibe there. I don't know if it's with the ocean, being closer to the ocean than Portland is necessarily. I don't know what it is, but I'm really excited about it.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for taking some time in what I know is a busy packing schedule for you to join the podcast. So thanks for being a part of this. And maybe we'll have to have another conversation after we get past this first couple months of school.
That sounds good. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Help Me Understand podcast. For more about my work, you can head over to drrobertdillon.com or follow me on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn. Don't forget to rate this podcast as it helps alert others to the great conversations and ideas happening in this space. Until next time, this is Dr. Robert Dillon reminding you that an intentional life is filled with awe, curiosity, and joy. We'll be right back.